Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup here on WCAI when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. And joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Sean.
And expected to join us a little later will be Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Tim Wood will join us on the phone as well. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And we expect to hear from Nelson Siegelman, managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Let's take a look at some of the news stories here on the Cape and the Islands. A story we've been watching unfold for the past few years seems to be coming to a head. The Assembly of Delegates, that's pretty much the legislature of our county, Barnstable County here, this week they voted to ask the Attorney General's office for help when it comes to understanding two energy-related organizations. And so tell us about that, Anne.
Right. The energy organizations that we're talking about is the Cape Light Compact and the Cape and Vineyard Electric Cooperative. Both of those agencies grew out of a collaboration between the county and town governments. The Cape Light Compact started back in 1997 as a way to purchase electricity and try and bring down the electric rates for Cape Cod businesses and residential customers. And then the Cape and Vineyard Electric Cooperative was started in 2007 by the county and towns and the compact as a way to pursue alternative energy projects around the Cape. There are critics of this group in terms of saying that there's not enough transparency between these groups of what they're doing financially, how they're using ratepayers' money, how the compact is using ratepayers' money to provide funds for the Cape and Vineyard Electric Cooperative. The assembly asked for information from the county and from the compact and the cooperative and felt that they didn't get that information in a timely fashion, and they got some and they wanted more. So the Assembly of Delegates said, we're going to ask the AG and the Inspector General to help us look at what the finances are and what the organizational issues are, because there's a lot of intertwining of people between the county and the two other, you know, the two electric agencies.
Right. And it seems like the assembly, some assembly members weren't quite clear of how it all works with the financials, were obviously, as you indicated, upset they didn't get all the information they asked for, seemingly should be public documents with these public organizations. So the assembly votes, and then it has to go to the three county commissioners.
Well, that's a point of contention on the part of the assembly. The county three county commissioners, which is the executive branch in county government, there are three commissioners voted at large. The attorney for the county said a resolution such as the one that the assembly did has to go and then be approved by the county commissioners. The county commissioners said, we do not support this, that the information that everybody has been looking for is on a website, that it's readily available, and that there's no fraud involved or waste that that's been proven in terms of the financial, how things are spent. So they said no. But in the meantime, the Assembly of Delegates, which has a 15 representatives, one from each town, went ahead and sent the letter asking for the help of these two, the AG and the IG, in helping them figure out how this operation works.
Right. And clearly it's a difficult operation to kind of wrap your head around, and if you don't have all the documentation that you think you need. But that, of course, as you say, is a point of contention as well.
Right.
With the leadership saying, yeah, we've provided what we should have to provide, it seems. But I think it's worth noting that the chairman of the county commissioners, Bill Doherty, but he also serves on the compact's board. He's involved in these two organizations as well. But he didn't recuse himself from this discussion or this decision to go to AG?
No, he didn't. Hmm. And in fact, when they did this vote, I think he was going to step down as the president and of the county commissioners, but couldn't because Mary Pett Flynn was joining by phone. And I'm not really sure why he didn't. They weren't all together in the same room. But this whole notion that he's on the board of the Cape Light Compact is what critics are pointing at. You know, people out in the community are pointing at and saying, this seems like there's a conflict of interest here.
Right.
That what, you know, and how are the ratepayers who are paying for electricity through the Cape Light Compact, how is their money being used? And is it being used in a way that is not wasteful and is going to benefit the Cape?
And so the commissioners said that they they and it's their belief that the two organizations have not committed fraud or waste or abuse.
Right.
No reason to go to the Attorney General.
And that they said that you would have to have something like that in order to ask for the help of the AG and the IG.
But how do you know if you have that? Right? I mean, if you don't have, isn't that what the AG comes
Well, there's
in
no
and looks
allegation,
at?
I would say. You would need
right.
allegations of, you know, this looks weird.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely a conflict. Something more black and white, they contend, does not exist.
So now we wait to see if the AG is going to take action or if they're going to wait to hear from the commissioners or...
Well, the Assembly of Delegates could override the commission's vote, but they need a two-thirds vote in order to do that. When the Assembly initially voted, it was about a little over 62% voted in favor of sending this letter. They... One, the Orleans representative wasn't there that day, but even if he were and voted in favor of this, they still wouldn't have reached the 66.6% needed to override the commission.
Oh.
So the Ron Bergstrom, who is the, I guess, the speaker of the Assembly of Delegations, said, we're just going to let this lie. We sent the letter. It's a little awkward if they do something, but I'm not going to put it on the agenda. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll continue to watch that. Let's talk about FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. We've been talking a lot about them because there's been some changes in flood zones here on the Cape and across the state. I think this is a reaction to Sandy and some of the flooding they saw there. But people were appealing some of these new flood zones.
Right. These are flood zones that I think they were released earlier this year. And boy, did they cause a controversy in the sense that people found that who had not been in a flood zone found that all of a sudden they were, and they were looking at home insurance rates going up $10,000 to $20,000 a year, and this includes businesses, but only those who have a federally insured mortgage are affected by this, which is a good number of people. And residents had until October 17th to appeal their placement in these new flood zones. And we found out earlier this week that of the appeals that were made on Cape Cod, three of them were accepted. FEMA is not telling us how many appeals they received.
I wonder why that is. Okay.
But they did say they did in three cases, one in Dennis that they found was not, they were improperly put in a flood zone. There was another in North Chatham and in Wellfleet. In at least the Dennis and North Chatham cases, there were about six each property owners in each case, and they went and got engineers or surveyors to come and really look at the property and say where it is and what the sea level where they were in relation to sea level, and because of that technical information, they were allowed to the appeal was accepted. We did see, though, that in one town, a town planner sent an email to the FEMA and said, this – I can't remember the name of the street, but this street is on top of a hill.
Hamilton Cartway.
Right. And that was not taken off the map. The FEMA is saying we only look at this technical data that is collected by professionals, surveyors or engineers.
So it seems like it's hard to know how successful because they
right.
won't tell you out of how many these
right.
three were chosen. But it seemed like you had to really hire an engineering firm in
exactly.
order to have – I mean, what a burden to be placed on a homeowner.
Well, and the other thing is you had to know. I know that coming up to the October 17th deadline for filing an appeal, there were selectmen saying, we don't know if people even know – have looked at these maps. So there may be people who don't even know that they've been placed in this zone and are going to have a rude awakening when they get their home insurance bill.
And state officials are still trying to address this?
Well, federal officials, state and federal officials, because this comes out of federal legislation. The flood insurance is underwritten. It's underwritten by the government. It's kind of a high risk pool type of insurance where people pay into it. That insurance pool is billions of dollars in the red, and they're trying to figure out ways to get it back in the black and this was one of those ways. But federal legislators are saying we had no idea that it was going to translate into 20 and, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 increases in year annual insurance, flood insurance. So there are attempts to delay this so that they can tweak it a little. It's so far that hasn't happened. But I know our congressional delegation is looking at that and working with the state. And I think there's other places around the country that are trying to delay this so that it could, you know, not have this effect, because it's not only that the burden on the homeowner to come up with this amount of money, but it's also, it really reduces the value of property if trying to sell your house. And by the way, there's a $20,000 flood insurance if you get a federally insured mortgage.
And let's go to the phone when Sally Rose is joining us. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. How are you doing, Sally?
Very well, Sean. Thank you.
We've been watching this story, another story we've been watching unfold with the police chief. Maybe start with a little of the background for folks who aren't familiar with what's been happening in the town, and then the news this week.
Okay. A lot of people know or don't know the chief, police chief, was suspended by the town manager with pay since September 12th, and that came after the police unions issued a vote of no confidence in the chief. That was basically after, again, several incidents that the chief was part of. One was when he started yelling at bartenders in a restaurant bar one night after the election, and for a song that was playing that was critical of police. There were several other also incidents that raised questions about his behavior, including that he got campaign signs from one candidate for selectman for that during that election and distributed them from the police station. Now, this week has been quite a busy week. Two nights ago on Wednesday, his contract with the town was terminated by the town manager, Sharon Lynn, during a disciplinary hearing. So this is 2 years before his contract was set to expire, and, of course, after these many months of controversy. So several members of the police department were called by town council to testify against Jaron during this hearing. But from what his attorney was saying, Jaron plans to appeal the decision to a committee of arbitrators. Interestingly, his contract lays out a multi-step process for those appeals. The first step is the committee of local arbitrators, and if the local arbitrators don't reverse the decision, he can then bring his case to arbitrators in Boston or to the Orleans District Court or to Barnstable Superior Court, and any of those could also reverse the decision. And if it does, the chief would then be entitled to back pay, benefits, and attorney's fees. Something else, as you had suggested, something else interesting happened earlier this week at the regular Monday night selections meeting. Police union leaders read a very strongly worded response to the Markham report. Just as a reminder, that's the report that we talked about last week by the independent investigator looking into the chief's behavior over the last several months. The union, basically the statement, slammed the Markham report. They said that while the report concluded that Jaron did act inappropriately on election night and violated town policies by distributing campaign signs at the police station, it failed in many instances to accurately reflect the severity of Jaron's actions that led to the union's vote of no confidence.
So they're saying the report didn't go far enough.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right. Basically, they called several of its conclusions insulting, fatuous beyond absurdity.
Was that at that same meeting? Wasn't one selectman calling for another selectman to resign and all that rancor there?
Yes. Tom Donegan, the selectman that was newly elected in that May 7th election, was calling for Austin Knights, who is the chair, him to step down as chair.
I see.
Austin Knight is the one whose campaign signs were in the police station and supposedly being distributed by the chief.
And Knight says that he knew the chief had asked for campaign signs, but he had no idea that the signs were going to be given to officers, he says, and he says that he wouldn't have allowed that.
Well, right, and then there are some conflicting instances. Because, yes, I think the report itself said that he wasn't sure who was picking them up. He did know it was going to, you know, the police station or police officers or something like that. So it was all, there's sort of a kind of a muddle of information around that. ultimately, though, there was no second to Donegan's request for him to step down as chair, so that didn't happen.
In the report that came out Monday, and maybe Sally Rose knew this already, but more details about what happened at that bar the night that the Squealing Pig, where the song was playing and the chief was upset, he sent officers in to get the names of all the people who were in the bar.
Right.
And people felt very intimidated by that, according to the union president.
Yeah, that doesn't make a lot of sense. It's hard to understand how the police chief being upset with the bar staff playing a song ends up with patrons being questioned or their names being taken down. Sally, any clarity on what that was about?
Well, I think one of the things that the report did highlight, the Markham report did highlight, that I think that it was clear that Jaron did feel that this song was being played, whether it was or not. He felt it was being played deliberately, so he felt he was being targeted.
Uh-huh.
Now, he then took that after. I think that made him angry, and he then, you know, sent. We heard varying reports. We heard first that he asked for IDs. What the report then said was that he sent an officer back there to get the IDs. So I think, you know, the problem ultimately is, while it's understandable that he got upset because he felt he was being targeted, it nonetheless was an inappropriate response for a police chief, for a town leader, for a town authority.
Yeah. Okay.
And then further, once he even left the place, he then sent someone to take IDs, which, well, to me, raises the level of intimidation.
I see. Well, I must say that is a very violent anti-police song, so I could understand he might react to it in some way. And it was extremely controversial when it came out, but wasn't it like 20-year-old song? Okay. At the same time all this has been going on, there's been some discussion about the size of the police force and whether it's been an appropriate size for a town that grows so large in the summer and over the all. It seems like every Provincetown's packed almost all year long these days. But and then it really does shrink down in population when we hit the real cold of winter. And so a report came out related to that.
Right. And actually, I honestly don't have a lot of background on that at this point. But I believe it found that the level that we are out is roughly appropriate for the town.
Yeah, I guess they were saying that because Provincetown is surrounded on three sides by water, it makes mutual aid much more difficult. And so they do have a staff of 19. I guess they have three people on the road and a sergeant on each of the shifts. And they're saying that that's appropriate, even though it's their population might not look like it supports that. It's just geographically one of the truisms that they're facing there. But they did suggest that they have a changing the role of two detectives, making one a detective sergeant and putting one detective in a patrol car. And that would mean that they would have to train the entire police force on crime scene investigation techniques if they did that.
Oh, I see. Oh. Sally, there's another story you have this week, and it's about harbor water quality, a positive story about the improvement of harbor water quality. I was really interested in what they suspect the reason of that is. Where that is.
Well, right. It is interesting. And this comes from the DPW department in Provincetown. And certainly, as anyone who's visited Provincetown over the last couple of years knows, there's been tons of road work going on pretty nonstop during fall and spring for the repaving of Commercial Street. First, it was replacing water mains and then repaving over that. And it's certainly a welcome event, the repaving, because it's been pretty bumpy. So the paving that's being laid is a porous pavement, and that's allowing for better filtering of stormwater. The stormwater, as it flows over, filters first through that porous layer of pavement, and then underneath there are several layers of stone and gravel. So as it flows through, before it goes out through the outfall system and into the Provincetown Harbor. So this is considered kind of a state-of-the-art pavement, and it is being credited for a sharp drop in beach closures in the downtown area.
Hmm.
In 2013, the town had no beach closures at all in that downtown area where it had been repaved from Johnson Street to Winthrop Street. A year ago, there were a total of 8 closures because of high levels of harmful bacteria.
All right. Well, maybe we'll be seeing more of that type of pavement in other areas of the Cape.
Right. Right. We'll hope that it doesn't have any sort of other side effects.
Right. I know. Sally Rose is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Thanks so much, Sally.
Thank you, Sean.
This is the News Roundup on WCAI, and we're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And let's talk about Sheriff James Cummings, Barnstable County Sheriff. He appears to be at odds with many of the police chiefs on Cape Cod over a dispatch center that Cummings wants the sheriff's department to open and operate.
Right. This is, you know, a lot of communities are finding that by regionalizing, they can save money. So the police chiefs and fire chiefs through the Barnstable County Regional Emergency Planning Committee put a application for a grant to look at opening a regional dispatch center. At the same time, so did Sheriff Cummings. Mm. And Sheriff Cummings won the grant back in August. And even leading up to these two grants, you had a pretty contentious back and forth between the two groups. The Barnstable County Sheriff is saying, I'm already doing dispatch. Right now, they're doing dispatch for about 10 towns for fire departments. And for our other departments, relaying the 911 calls to the proper police department.
All right.
And so he's saying we're already set up. The chiefs are saying, you know, we want this to be locally controlled. We don't want the state to control this. And the sheriff is saying, I've got the space.
I don't understand. So the state, how would the state be controlling
it if it's the sheriff? The sheriff department is under the state.
That's a new thing.
In 2009, right. 6 sheriff departments were put under the state, and they're now, rather than county, state agencies. And on Tuesday, the sheriff had a luncheon. There were about 80 public safety officials and other Cape Cod from Cape Cod. And he had a luncheon at which they shared their plan, what they're doing a feasibility study with the $200,000 grant that they received. And this money comes from the 911 commission, the emergency phone call 911 commission. And he said that they are going to pattern their dispatching, regional dispatching center after that was built in Essex County. And they're trying to figure out, you know, where this facility would be. The State Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance would build the new facility. And they're looking at somewhere either on Joint Base Cape Cod or near the Barnstable County Correctional Facility, which is right next to the base.
And the Essex County facility doesn't, they don't have full interest in that facility either. I think only 6 out of the 34 towns or communities in Essex County bought in on that dispatch center as
right.
well. Get to the quote. I mean, this sounds like quite a meeting when you have the sheriff looking out at the police chief and really kind of, I don't know, I think one of the chiefs said kind of lecturing them.
Right. Well, what the chiefs are saying, again, they're still smarting from a situation with CMED, which is the dispatch between an ambulance, the paramedic in an ambulance or at the scene of something, and Cape Cod Hospital or whatever hospital is nearby, so that they can start emergency treatment right away. And the sheriff's office had long paid for that. But as soon as he went to the state, under the state purview, he said, I don't have the money in my budget to cover this anymore.
To pay for the communication between the on-site folks dealing with the emergency and people back at the hospital.
Right.
I see.
And so he wanted to assess the towns for that service. And it was kind of out of the blue, and towns were kind of caught off guard. So there's that tension behind. That's why they're saying we don't want this to happen again. And so there's this back and forth at this luncheon about, you know, this whole issue of state versus local. And Cummings finally said it's time for some people to put on their big boy pants and get on and get this thing done. They're moving forward.
I can't imagine that went over very well. Okay. Tim Wood is joining us on the phone. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Sorry, I left you on hold there for a few minutes. We got caught up talking about all the problems that some of the police are experiencing here. Tell us about the Monomoy School District.
Yeah, the Monomoy School District is in the news again this week. A few years ago, when officials were planning the combination of the Harwich and Chatham school systems, they projected that the merger could be done without sacrificing many jobs, that attrition and retirement would eliminate the any duplication in staffing that resulted from combining the middle and high schools. With that merger becoming a reality next September, Superintendent of Schools Scott Carpenter announced last week that that previous outlook was unrealistic, and the budget that he's submitting for next year will eliminate 15 full-time positions, 15-plus full-time positions. And many of those staff members actually knew that their jobs would be ending in June with the combination of the system of the two schools. But the magnitude of the layoff actually took some people by surprise. It was larger than people expected. And Carpenter said that this became necessary because not all of the retirements that happened were in areas where there were redundancies in the two school systems, and that after shifting teachers around to accommodate new curriculum that they're putting in place, there were still some positions that needed to be cut. They include teachers, cafeteria workers, a school nurse, some administrative assistants, principal positions. There's going to be only one principal instead of two, like they have now for the middle and high schools.
So a lot of savings with these cuts?
The savings will, I think, total something around $750,000.
Yeah.
And of course, they've been the school system is being pushed by the towns to keep the budgets down. Especially Harwich, they're hurting because their school assessment has actually gone up because of the merger, and they're looking for any kind of savings that that can be realized here.
Was that increase unanticipated by Harwich?
They were expecting more of a savings than what they what is going to be realized by the combination of the schools that happens next September when the new high school opens, and we end up with one high school and one middle school instead of two high schools and two middle schools. The initial projection back when regionalization was being discussed was something in the range of $4.7 million. It's going to be about half that. Harwich had been counting on that savings. Now they're sort of scrambling to figure out what they're going to do about that.
Okay, Tim, let's briefly talk about this skateboard park. Despite all the recreational activities on the Cape, the younger folks often say, look, there's not a lot to do here, and skateboard parks have become pretty popular over the past decades. What happened to the one in Chatham?
Sure. Chatham's had a skateboard park for something like 17 years. It's located, previously was located at the airport. It had to be taken out of that location because the airport has to put in a new building in that site. It was the only site they could put the building in. In May, the town appropriated $110,000 to build a new park. And at that town meeting, it was specified by an amendment that the new skateboard park would go on another location on the airport property. But that didn't sit well with the Park and Rec Commission, which oversees the park. They had preferred another location closer to the center of downtown, near the community center, where they say kids already go there. It made more sense to put the park there. But neighbors didn't like a park going in that location. They said it would be too noisy, it would be a nuisance. So the airport location was chosen through the town meeting process. Now the Park Commission has come back with another site where they'd like to see the park, which is Volunteer Park, which is in South Chatham, where there's a couple ball fields and a playground there. They say that location is better than the airport site because it's already a recreational facility. Kids go there already. Last week, the selectmen, they seem to agree with that position, but they said they're hamstrung by the town meeting vote, which ties the funding to the airport location. So the selectmen, it's a little convoluted here, but the selectmen agreed to consider an article for next May's town meeting, which would change the location for the site and thus the funding. It's a bit problematic for skateboarders in town because it means that the park construction of a new park is going to be delayed by a couple months or even a half a year because of having to go back to town meeting. And I know some skateboarders in town, and they don't really care where the new park goes. They would just like a park.
Yeah, they just want a park, right? Of course,
they just want a place to skate because they know if they go downtown or if or they or whatever, they'll get kicked out. They'll get in trouble.
They'll be hassled. Sure.
And they want, and so they want their park, but they're sort of caught up in a political process here.
Okay. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks so much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in the studio is Ann Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning.
Story this week about the prices of gas on the vineyard versus on the mainland of Cape Cod. What did you find out?
Well, we asked our reporter, Tony Omer, to look at what we describe as the differential. And by that, I mean the cost of a gallon of gasoline on the mainland, say, in Falmouth, versus what it is on the vineyard. And in the 90s, that differential used to be about 50 cents, 60 cents. Now it's up to a dollar. So, for example, according to AAA last week, a gallon of average was selling for $3.41. We have it on the vineyard for about $4.35. So that's quite a spread, but getting to the bottom of it is a little bit difficult. Most of the vineyard suppliers we talked to said that they determine the price based on what they have to pay when the truck comes over with gasoline, and they add a markup for their costs and also a small profit. Certainly it has to do with just volume. In the winter, particularly, the volume of gasoline that gets sold on the vineyard is relatively small compared to stations on the mainland. So that's part of it. But it's certainly a subject we've written about over the years, and I don't know that we've ever come up with an explanation that satisfies everybody, but it's often, you know, one of the funny things is when we get new reporters sometimes, they'll come in and they'll say, oh, I'd like to do a story on the high price of gasoline, and we just sort of roll our eyes and, you know,
right.
pull out all the old copy, because not much has changed, it just keeps going up.
Well, the same thing on the mainland over and over again. Why is it more expensive on Cape Cod when you're just driving over a bridge than it is off Cape Cod? And we've seen that story, and you never really get a good answer. I don't even know who you go to for an answer on that. Let's talk about the arrest of a gentleman who was accused of stealing scrap copper. And that's an ongoing problem all over, folks stealing copper with the price of copper so high.
Well, we went into that arrest in some detail. You know, as certainly at a community newspaper, one of the things you often see is police reports. And for people who have never seen a police report, they can be really interesting. You know, often what you see in the newspaper and certainly on TV is just the tip of the story. And this police report by Eggertown Detective Mike Snowden, when I got that and started looking through it, I thought, you know, there's a little bit more to this story than just police arrest somebody for stealing copper. What the essential story is that this fellow was going behind the Schwab Electric Company in our airport business park and dipping into this pile of scrap copper that David Schwab lets his employees collect, and basically it benefits the employees. They collect this scrap copper if they're renovating a house and they're removing things. They gather that, and then ultimately they can sell it at a scrapyard, and it's extra money for the men and women who work for him. This thief was going in there and went in a number of times, stole it, and according to the investigation, sold it at a New Bedford scrapyard. But what struck me as really interesting was the amount of detective work and effort by the Eggertown police, and I think it's reflective of a small community, because when you have police who live in your community and they know the people, they really are invested in trying to help them. And in this case, the police really went to some effort, even, for example, identifying the type of sneaker the thief was using by the treadmark and the print. So it's a story that reflects well on the community and the police here.
All right, thanks, Nelson. Nelson Siegelman, digging deeper into these stories that on the
what
surface.
We do.
That's right. I understand. Nelson, thank you very much for
You're
joining
welcome.
Us. Anne Brennan here in our Woods Hole studio. I understand you just got a message on your phone about a story we've been following for a while, and that is the Dennis Yarmouth School District's interest in installing a solar array.
Right, and as you may recall, last summer the Zoning Board of Appeals denied the request to install these solar panels, saying that they may be dangerous, and so the school superintendent found another way and said that they wouldn't need the approval of the Zoning Board of Appeals if there was some education value to this. So she went to the building commissioner and said, these have an education value. We're going to be using these too in part of our science courses and other curriculum. And so the building inspector did give her the permit. And there was a resident who appealed that decision. And last night, the Zoning Board of Appeals voted not to reverse the building commissioner's permit. So these will now be installed at the schools in Yarmouth. Dennis had already approved these solar arrays. It's expected to save the regional school district about $3.8 million over 20 years, and the Yarmouth end was about 25% of the project. So this is a major victory for the school. And I just want to say that in order for the school district to get the state energy incentives money back for putting these in, the panels now must be installed and generating power by June, which is why they were trying to get this done last fall. So I understand from this email I got that people are up and installing. Workers are already installing these.
Really?
Today.
Today.
Yes.
Oh, wow. That's moving quick. Okay. Let's stick with schools and let's talk about the Harwich Middle School, which is for sale.
Right. This is we're seeing quite a few buildings as schools close on the Cape. Towns are trying to put them up for sale because they're very expensive when they're sitting vacant. They have to heat them so that the pipes don't freeze.
Sure.
And maintain them. And it can be a pretty expensive proposition.
Well, maybe I shouldn't say it's for sale. They haven't quite decided if
Right.
they want to sell it or not. Right.
Well, they definitely want someone else to take over when the middle school closes next fall. What's happening, as you heard earlier, the Monomoy School District is building, or it's a new district, is building a new high school. Once that high school is built, the middle school will then move into the existing high school, leaving the Harwich Middle School vacant. The town has a repurposing committee looking at various uses for it, and the town planner, David Spitz, came up with an idea to use it for affordable housing or senior housing. That's what a lot of towns end up doing. And this plan will go before the repurposing committee on Monday. And if the repurposing committee likes it, then it goes before the town selectmen. And the selectmen are saying, we want to at least sell it or lease it a couple of days after the Harwich Middle School is vacated.
Okay. And so we've heard a lot. Let's move on to the next story. We've heard a lot about the Affordable Care Act and all the trouble with the websites. And now a story this week about some trouble with the state website, right?
Right. Well, this is for people who are currently do not have health insurance, or people who are on the medical security plan, which is what people who are collecting unemployment insurance are on, they need to sign up by December 23rd. And this group of people also, because there's subsidies involved, the state computer system has to be talking to the federal computer system in order to figure out your income, what your residency situation is, a more complex type of application. And as we know, the federal government has been having these exact same problems with healthcare.gov, of these different computers talking to each other to figure out, do I get a subsidy? How much do I? And so in order to meet this December 23rd deadline, the so-called navigators, the local healthcare agencies like social service agencies are allowing people to come in and file their application on paper, and then they are then faxed to the state agency that's handling this so that they can get these insurance plans in place by January 1st, meet that deadline. But if you're somebody who is on MassHealth already, you don't need to worry. If you're somebody who is just getting into the and don't need a subsidy but are just getting into the health insurance exchange, people are being able very successful at is getting through that process totally electronically, and there have been no glitches or very minor glitches in those cases.
Now, I thought I read there was an event coming up that might be able to help folks.
For the people who need to meet the December 23rd deadline, tomorrow at the Cape Cod Community at Cape Cod Community College, there will be financial counselors from several organizations such as Harbor Community Healthcare and Community Action Committee of Cape Cod and the Islands. They'll be there to help people navigate this whole registration process. But they're also, in order to try and make it fun, they're going to have hot chocolate, raffles, candy canes, okay, and Santa Claus. So
Santa Claus will come. Okay.
Right. So that's there for people.
It's a busy guy this time.
Yes.
All right, let's talk about a real interesting story about something Bourne High School is doing and partnering up with 4Cs, Cape Cod Community College, in order to...
I have to say this is my favorite story of the week.
Why is that?
Well, because I'm paying college tuition now and about to pay more if the college gods are, good to my kids.
They don't listen to my show.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Anyway, the superintendent of Bourne Schools has worked with Cape Cod Community College so that a certain number of students who apply and they think can handle it will go full time to Cape Cod Community College and end up at the end of their high school career with both a high school degree and an associate's degree from the community college. This is something that there's already kids who are doing something like this, maybe taking classes at the college instead of high school, but the parents are paying for that. This is different. He estimates that about 20 students a year would qualify for this program, and that the town of Bourne the Bourne School District would pay, the tuition and fees. The students would have to pay for books, but it is, and they're figuring it's going to be about $130,000 a year. But it is a way to get through. And really get through high school, and if you can get through the program and get both degrees at the same time, gives you a huge jump on your college career. If, at least in undergrad, you could cut 2 years off. Dan Esquino, I think I say that right, who's president of Mount Wachusett, where they're doing it with the local school district there, is saying that, and he actually was a former dean at Cape Cod Community College, is saying that they're seeing, about half of the students get to the point where they finish with both degrees. Others have quite a number of college credits by the time that they're finished. And they also know, though, that students going to Cape Cod Community College and they're 16 years old need a different type of support than your average student.
Right.
And they plan to put that in place as well. But in one case, Daniel Esquino said that there was a kid he dealt with who was able to finish and 24 credit hours at the community college and then got into Brown University. So this is really a way that I think, like you said, Bourne is trying to attract students to their schools.
I think I said
schools.
That before the show. This could be a good thing for Bourne as they try to retain students in their community.
Right. And for families of students who can do this, it's quite it could save them a lot of money on college tuition.
Well, that was your favorite story of the week. My favorite story of the week was actually on an inside page and brought tears to my eyes about a brother decorating the gravesite of his brother.
Right. Charles Iliff, his brother Billy Iliff, was killed in a shooting accident 40 years ago this year. And it happened in early December back in 1972. After Billy died, his mother started a tradition of putting a Christmas tree at his graveside and decorating the tree. And his mother continued to do that until she became ill, and she died in 1999.
So 17 years.
Right. And so Charles Iliff, you know, just couldn't bring himself to do this every year.
Right. He used to go with his mother every year.
Yeah, it was a tradition.
Yeah.
And so this year, I guess a lot of people, you know, through the years have said, are you going to do this? Are you going to do this? And this year, with the help of some of his friends, they did put up a Christmas tree that was donated by Matt Lambert at Lambert's Rainbow Fruit in West Yarmouth. Excuse me, on West Main Street in Hyannis. They had always donated the tree when the mother was alive to her, a little 4-foot tree. So they donated the tree, and Charles and his friends went and decorated it.
Yeah, it wasn't just Charles. I mean, there were a few people with him, and the writing on the story I thought was really good. Who wrote that story?
This story was written by Christine Hotchkeppel, who's actually one of our photographers, who often does everything. She writes, and she'll do video and take pictures, and she found this story, and I agree with you. I think she told it quite well.
And there's a quote at the end of the story that really struck me when this gentleman offered some advice to people who may be grieving at this time of year. And I think when you've lost someone at this, and the holidays can be somewhat lonely, somewhat challenging. So what did he say?
Well, he said, find someone you love who loves you back and ask them, will you help me?
Yeah. Anne Brennan, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything you wanted to promote? I know the Sunday paper.
There's going to be a story about deer hunting on Nantucket, and it's deer hunting season right now. And also look at the deer population is a lot bigger than they originally thought, and so we're taking a look at that.
And, of course, the interest in deer, a lot of it is around the tick problem that we have and the role that ticks play in the life cycle of deer.
Right, yeah. Right. And also the news that way more people might have Lyme disease than they expected.
And the Boston Globe has a remarkable story this morning about some children who are thought to have Lyme disease and who died because of heart problems.
Right, yeah, exactly.
We'll check that story out as well. That's what's happening. Anne Brennan joined me in our Woods Hole studio. Anne is the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Sean.
And great thanks to Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner and Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. They all called in. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran. This is WCAI.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.